Hello, I'm Jeffrey Players. I'm a professor at the University of Louvain in Belgium, and I'm also the chair of the research committee on social movements of the International Sociological Association. And today I'm here to share a few thoughts about democracy, what democracy has become today, and how there are multiple forms of democracy, how people try to become actors of their life and of the world, how it is very much connected to what you do in your daily life and the democracy we have today, but also with some question about how young people try to be actors in their daily life, in the way they deal with information, and also, more recently, they may be back to party politics. So this raises a lot of questions about what democracy means today, and I think that we have to think about these models of a multiple democracy to see how all these different way of becoming actors may work together, even if there are some tensions, how they may work together towards a more democratic and more fair and fairer world. Okay, thank you very much, Graham, for this very generous introduction. And thank you very much to all of you for being here. I would like to start with a statement that has become quite basic. Usually we focus on Europe when you talk about post-democracy, but actually I think it applies to most of our national governments. And I leave up to you what national means here, especially in Scotland. But Colin Clout, who is an English scholar, wrote a decade ago that while formal democracy is now solidly established in a record number of countries, the substance of democracy has considerably declined in the last decades. And which is, I think, quite true if we consider formal democracy. Of course, he tends to see the heyday on democracy in the 1970s, because everyone tends to consider that society was just so brilliant when he was between 20 and 30. So I guess we can also question the fact that in the 70s everything was so bright, for sure. But at the same time, it's true that all the countries today are called, many countries are democracies today. And that many parliaments don't have a say in many important things. We see this day in Europe, for example, these negotiations of the Transatlantic Treaty, we even don't know what is in this treaty. It's a secret negotiation, so it really challenges question what democracy means today. And actually, you know, I come from Belgium, and if you want to study post-democracy, I definitely would like to recommend you this excellent travel guide. You probably all know, I hope, the Lonely Planet. Well, we have something much better for Brussels. If you want to visit Brussels, please have a look at the Lobby Planet. And you will see that there's an incredible number of lobby in Brussels, more than in Washington. And I guess we can republish it also for London and for many different capital cities. Definitely, the lobbies are so important and we don't know always about them. Europe, at least the European Commission, could be a good case study for post-democracy. A lot of lobbies, technocrats, the rule of the Troika to decide instead of the people in the south of Europe, secret negotiations. Actually, we'll see most of these issues also at a national level, of course. So we always tend to focus on Europe for that, but we see it actually as in the same way at the national level. And then it's definitely connected with some very alarming survey. In the last European elections, abstention was really super high, and many young people voted for far-right parties. And that's definitely, for me, it's very much connected. I mean, this idea of that Europe has become less democratic and that young people believe less in Europe. So, of course, there's no point to contest the fact that there is some kind of post-democracy going on at the European level and at national level. My point is to say that this is, however, only a part of the picture. And so I went to see what happens in different countries in Western and Eastern Europe, particularly I also study Latin American countries, but this time I'll just focus on Europe. And I think that at the same time as we see post-democracy symptoms going on in different countries, we also see much more the grassroots, the expansion of democratic practices and democratic considerations in all realms of life. And we have to question this statement of post-democracy also by this very basic question: do we look at the right place when we look for democracy? We tend all to look at the same place, which is the prime minister's government. Well, actually, democracy has become quite different and is very lively at very different scales and in very different spaces. We need to look much more below the tip of the iceberg, as Graham Rogers said. We tend to understand the social movements and democracy through the media, which have all a very strong focus on institutions. And this is really important. It's part of the picture. It's just a part of the picture. It's just a piece of the puzzle. It's much more diverse. And I would like to invite you to look at least Europe this time, with an expanded idea of democracy, starting from below. And here I think that sociology of social movements, the sociology of emergencies, can help us to think democracy starting from what is happening in different places. Of course, there are most of the time small experiments. They are not perfect. They cannot change all the world. But at their size, they may change something very practically. And they should also help us to rethink democracy, rethink our way we live together in a different way, starting from small things that happen below. What does it mean in terms of, for a very small theoretical parenthesis here, what does it mean in terms of theoretical thinking about democracy, about political philosophy? First of all, I think that we have to think democracy beyond formal or institutional democracy. There have been two quite influential books by a French political scientist, Ronson Vallon, and the Australian one, he used to be based in the UK, John Keane. And both say that actually today, if our societies are democratic, it is not so much because there are elected parliaments. The real democracy is actually happening, is implemented by actors who monitor elected representatives, journalists, NGOs who check if the leaders are corrupted, if who denounce corruption, who denounce if they misbehave. So this is the idea of counter democracy for Ronson Vallon, monitoring democracy, to say that we have to, the main actors of democracy are actually not so much elected politicians, but people who control them. And this is the role of civil society, obviously. And I definitely think this is really important. I would, however, like to include that in the panorama, but also to go one step beyond. I think that we also have to think about democracy not only beyond institutional politics, parliaments, governments. We have also to think democracy beyond the relations between citizens and formal and institutional democracy. Democracy is also about the way we behave with each other. It's about the way we connect with others. It's about the way we consider each other as equal. And so democracy is not limited to the public sphere, it's also in the private sphere, obviously. And my claim today is to say that we have to open the box of democracy to think in different ways, in different realms of life, but also then, after that, to see how these different forms of democracy may fit together and have to work together, which is my proposal of multiple democracy. I hope to come to that. So I start with small movements sometimes, but initiatives that may help us to think about democracy today. And I think we have to focus as much on their successes as on their limits. Because of course, all these movements are very limited. If not, we wouldn't be here in the same world. If they would have changed the world as they would like to do, the world would already be very different. So I think we have to study much more carefully the limits of these movements too. That's the background. So I propose, actually, I've developed a bit the model, six kind of actors, and very quickly draw six elements of democracy out of that. Why do I focus on democracy? Also because I believe that in this decade, since 2010, and particularly in the happy part of the decade, I would say between 2010-11 and 2014, before all this mass repression against social movements in different countries and in most of the countries, actually. The newer movements almost all focused on democracy. There was a very strong will to renew democracy, to renew activism, but also what was at the core of most of these movements, what was the similarities of this movement, was that they all pointed towards the limits of formal democracy. Not only the concrete limits, also the structural limits. Concrete limits would be actual limits. It would be, well, this political party, Spanish Popular Party, is very corrupted. And indeed, there are so many politicians in jail today. So they were right to say it is a corrupted party. But something else is to say, it's not only that this party is more corrupted than other parties, it's that the system of representative democracy limits our own possibility to go towards a more democratic society. These are social limits. People talk about democracy without choice. Yes, we can vote, but actually if we vote for one party or the other, the politics will be about the same, policies will be about the same. And I think that one of the very key points today that has to be much better studied is the collusion between economic, media, and political elite. Collusions, it's one more step than corruption. Corruption means someone gives money to another one, that's classic corruption. Collusion means these are actually the same people. And this is something we could see in most of the movement that arose after the 2008 and 2009 financial crisis. Iceland, we don't talk enough about Iceland, a fantastic model of citizen movements. How did it start? Well, people realized actually after all the crash of the banks and all that, that one brother was at the government and the other one was the head of the bank. And there was actually many family ties between the government and the bank sector in Iceland. And this is exactly what we see in many countries. In Tunisia, the Ben Ali family, the husband was controlling politics and the wife, the economy. So for young people in Tunisia, it was not only that they couldn't become activists, they couldn't enter into political life. Actually, they couldn't enter a real economic life. Because if they wanted to, if they had some kind of entrepreneurial spirit, everything was closed. And this is really what how the revolution also started in Tunisia. Of course, you can see the same with Occupy Wall Street. This 1%, that's what I said, the 1% of the richest people, which Oxfam calculated it on the 1st of January 2016, the 1% owns more wealth than all the rest of the population of the world, more than the 99%. What Occupy Wall Street activists said is that the 1% is so wealthy that democracy cannot work anymore because they have such an impact on political actors and on the media, and the way the media frame our perspective, which is Mexico is another fantastic case. British journalist Joe Tuchman showed that the main television company had a contract with the man that became the president afterwards. So they had a contract to deal with his image. So really it was they manufactured a candidate for the presidential election and he won, obviously. Media are so powerful today. And then afterwards there are succession of scandals of corruption, collusion. And I guess that, of course, if you go to the media world in the UK, the power of the few rich people is extremely important. And you had many other cases, Berlusconi in Italy, many other cases. I mean, this collusion is really a key element of our political system today. And so this movement came to question that, to challenge the collusion between political, economic, and media elite. But if you look at the first case, the Occupy movement, Indignados movement, which were the Spanish Occupy movement, but 6 months before, Wall Street, all these movements actually, they didn't spend so much energy in denouncing the lack of democracy. They put most of the energy in implementing democracy on the squares, in the neighborhood. So this idea of that democracy is not only and not so much a demand, it's not so much something you demand from a government, it's something you want to apply in around you, in your movements, on the square. They develop a wide range of practical practices of democracy and were quite efficient. I used to say that a few times I attended a General Assembly at Occupy London around St. Paul's Cathedral. It was really fascinating for me to see how. I remember very well a meeting in 45 minutes, they were able, with 200 participants, to take two or three very strategic important decisions. 200 people, everyone took part in decisions, they split in small groups and then came together and all died. I mean, I went back to my colleagues at the University of Louvain, we have 7 colleagues in my department, and in 3 hours we don't decide anything. These young people, they were able to decide something in a very particular way, very creative about the process, really huge achievement. So what I want to do is to implement democracy in local public spaces, assemblies, camps, neighborhoods. And a few years ago, everyone asked me, so why has the Occupy movement disappeared? And actually, as soon as you went on the ground, you saw these people, not all, but most of them very active in housing movements, in food movements, in our local democracy. Most of these young people told me, well, we learned what we had to learn on the square. What was the point to remain there all the time? It's about changing society from below. So the key point is to implement democracy. It's a personal commitment with a prefigurative activist, which means to implement your own value in your practices. That's a key, the starting point and the aim and the objective of the movements. And that's not new at all. I mean, I took an old quote here from 2003 to show the continuity between this movement and the global justice movements and many movements before. Here in a European Social Forum, an activist wrote, we don't separate our practices and aims. We choose a horizontal, anti-sexist, self and eco-managed way of operating. So it's not only about the way you take your decision, it's also about the way you cook in camp. It's about the way you behave in the daily life, basically. So the consistency between your means and your ends, the fact that you implement your value is really the key in this kind of movements. And lived experience, the experience that you live in camps is so important. What they do in a very different way is to build spaces of experience. These are places sufficiently autonomous and distant from capitalist society which permit actors to do three things. To live according to their own principle, which is the meaning of autonomy, to knit different social relations and to express your subjectivity. So really the social relations, the way you behave with each other is really an important component of that. It's not something funny aside of the aim of the movement, it's really part of the movement. And these camps, all the camps, are, most of them at least, are sporadic. They don't stay there forever, but many research have shown that they have a huge and long-lasting impact on people's life. Even there's some research show that 15 years after the camps, the people who took part in that, in this kind of experience had a significant difference in their political opinion. So it has a significant impact on individual people, especially because in these movements, democracy is not only a demand, it's not only a practice, it's also a personal commitment. And that's something that we find in many of the movements of today. Here's another quote, from Paris. I think that things happen much through a change of oneself. After having been part of the Indignados, the Occupy movement, I don't see the people in the same way anymore. I realize that everyone has something to say, and I try to care about everyone's opinion and also about everyone as a human being. So it's very much something about personal relationship. So we see this ethics of democracy. We have to put subjectivity much more back in. Democracy is a way of life. It's a demand. It's a practice. But we should also see it as a personal commitment that is embodied in these practices. The thing is, these kind of movements, the assemblies, most of the time they see the social change starting at a local level. And very often they reduce democracy to the local level. This is not a quote. I'm not sure democracy can work beyond a certain level. Beyond the local or city level, it is rather about coordination than democracy. So here my question. Can we really change the world just with a small neighborhood assembly? Is it possible to transform it? Yes, we can have an impact at the same time. Direct democracy on a square, direct democracy in a small neighborhood assembly is also limited. You can take the case of Mexico. Mexico is a country where plenty of movements are working very hard at a local level, at a local scale to transform the world. And they've been doing it for decades. At the same time, so there are plenty of alternative islands of democratic practices, democratic education, and all that. At the same time, Mexico, as you all know, has become a more violent, more unequal, and a much less democratic country today. So my point is not that it's not worth to do. Yes, they're efficient in some way, but they're also limited. You cannot change a country only by multiplying small islands of alternatives. How do you go from local change to world transformation? So far, from what I could see, it's not only by multiplying small islands of changes in an ocean of neoliberalism or capitalism or whatever you want. But all these experiences become much more interesting if you consider it as a piece of the solution, not the global solution, but a piece of the puzzle of democracy. I personally even wouldn't have time to spend all my day and night deciding on every single point. For me, I'm quite glad that there are some form of deliberative democracy, delegations, because I'm not sure I can decide on everything. I don't have the competencies, the knowledge. But on some point, yes, I would like to intervene a bit more. So it's much more about seeing it as a part of the solution makes it, for me, much more interesting. Then I probably have to go a bit, not so much in detail, on the second one, which you hopefully know as well, which is, I call it responsible democracy, which is a surprise for me because I didn't expect them to talk so much about responsibility. But I would call it in the UK the transformation, the transition movement. Transition towns, degrowth, alternative food networks, city gardening, and so many alternatives who are partly concerned with the ecology but also with democracy. It's also about prefigurative activism, but this time it's not only about implementing your concept of democracy in collective decision-making processes, it's about implementing it in your daily life, in all realms of daily life. How can you behave as a democratic citizen when you go to vote, when you take decision on the squares, and then go and buy some Coca-Cola, some eat in a restaurant that exploits its workers? How is it possible? I mean, as I said, these people insist on the consistency between your values and your practices. And you cannot separate private life and public life, politics and just my way of having fun. And here, they want to implement their value, democratic values, responsibility, beyond these kind of decision spaces in just daily life. In this perspective, it's about prefigurative activism, but also the subjective aspect is even more important here. The relation to oneself is really central in these movements. And changing yourself, they are more and more conscious that changing oneself is, that each of us is part of the problem and of the solution. So here are two quotes from also about this, the centrality of the relation to oneself. This most probably more developed in this kind of transition movements, but that you can find back in most of today's movements, most of today's progressive movements, I should say. For example, I like very much the first one. I have done it, so to get involved in transition movements, green movements, because I don't want anymore to take part in that. I don't want to tell to myself that somewhere people are suffering from my choices as a consumer. So it's not only that somewhere people are suffering from that. It's that I tell it to myself, and that's my problem. It's not egoistic at all, but it's a relation with yourself. And so what makes activists work, the motivation, the way you build it, the way the energy you find, is actually much more based in this kind of very ethical relation with yourself, about this idea of personal commitment and personal responsibility. And here we may go closer to French philosopher Jean Concière. He says that democracy is an emancipation project that lies in, I quote, people practices oriented toward the presupposition of the equality of anyone with anyone. The fact that if everyone is equal, is it right for me to buy a product that has been brought to me by a sale of exploitation of people? Is it right for me to travel by plane just because I have the money to do it and without any kind of responsibility for the pollution it will cause? So once again, it's always a self question, which is really central here. And more broadly, I don't have time to develop that, but I think we have to, it led us in a broad reflection about democracy beyond the state. The idea that there is a monopoly of democracy in the state, the state has taken the monopoly over democracy, is either a misconception or a trap. I would rather say a trap. But anyway, the idea is that it's not the fact that you vote and then it's okay, no, I'm fine, I'm in a democratic country, everything is okay. No, not at all. Actually, you have to implement it every day, you have to work on it. And many countries are actually not democratic at all, even if they have relatively fair elections. So the idea here is also, if you go, for example, with the last one, Miguel Arenzur, a philosopher, he says that he has a book called Democracy Against the State, saying that the state actually many times impedes us to build more democratic, more horizontal relationship. I personally wouldn't go so far, because I still believe that the state is needed for many things, and the state is a part of democracy. Once again, the idea is to take different concepts of democracy as a piece of the puzzle, of the general idea of democracy. But at least what I take from his argument definitely is that we have to take democracy out of the monopoly of the state. Then maybe a third idea of democracy, a third component, would be informational democracy. Yes, taking this word from Manuel Castells. And this battle of information. So everyone is very much aware of that. And of course, here, internet has changed quite a lot. A lot of access to information, a lot of ideology of the internet too, the fact that everyone would have access to everything, which is of course not true. And with new challenges, how can we bring more information, and not only more information, relevant information to citizens? And how can citizens actually find relevant information? And here, of course, while there was so much hope in the internet as opening an information society, information to everyone, at the same time we see that there are still mass media who manufacture concern, information, and the way, of course, have a look at the British speciality, the tabloids, you see how much reality is framed in different ways. And once again here, the collusion is really central. In many of these actors denounce actually the collusion between political, economic, and media elite. Berlusconi is extreme case, Rupert Murdoch, and many other, of course. Just a small point here, I would like to stress that if we think about becoming a better informed society, of course, internet is part of it. But we have to go beyond the online-offline divide. Social media, everyone talk about Facebook movements, Twitter movements, the fact that with Twitter and Facebook we would be in a much more democratic open world, which is only partly true. Social media have not replaced mass media. We have to think about our media ecology in a democratic arenas as much more complex. And actually social media have been aggregated, have been added to other forms of media that include mass media. Most people still have most of their information through mass media. And even when social media have been so important, most of the time it was when they were articulated to mass media. Everyone, for example, take the Facebook case and the YouTube case, Facebook and YouTube to explain the Egyptian revolution, because some activists broadcasted some violent repression on YouTube. And then they say, that's what make more and more people going to the street. Well, you have to look at that more closely, and you see that what made many people going to the street, going down to the street, was actually the fact that these small movies were actually taken by Al Jazeera and broadcasted there. So they took it from YouTube, and then they diffused it, they broadcast it on with mass media, and then big part of the population had access to it. So really, it's not about social media, it's about the articulation between different forms of media. And this kind of combination sometimes goes in the same direction, like this case in Egypt, but most of the time also goes to many clashes. Of course, there are very strong confrontation between activists, social media, and mass media. If you look at demonstration in Mexico or Brazil, they don't march towards the presidential palace. They march towards the headquarters of the mainstream media, Globo in Brazil, Televisa in Mexico. So here it's maybe not as strong as it is in Brazil or in Mexico, but still we see the same picture of confrontation between this media and really the mass media are really important. I think also today we are much more, not more skeptical, but more not so naive maybe about the internet and this informational society. In particular, well, there are four other points, I won't have time to do all of them. Maybe the first one, so many people, most of social scientists believe that internet was going together with a culture of opening and tolerances. But actually, that internet was based on the encounter with everyone, it would spread democracy values, democratic values and all that. Actually, we see today that hate speeches and racism spread on the internet in an unbelievable manner. It's just incredible. If you look at the website in Hungary, for example, but also look at what happens after the attacks in Paris. I happened to watch a small text in a newspaper in Belgium and in France, and then I had dozens of people just saying some racist, giving some racist explanation to that, saying that all Arab people should just go back home and all that. Something that no one would dare to say in a normal public space, but then all of a sudden the internet, online, you just say everything and it becomes part of the more general public. So really, internet actually may help some progressive movement. It also, of course, helps to spread hate speeches, which we should care much more about. Also, of course, internet is not a space freed of states and politicians. More and more politicians care very much about the image online, and they not only they organize a way to get a good image, but also to make sure that the adversary had a bad image, including for social movements. Of course, not to tell about repression, control, China, Egypt, Turkey. I mean, people, my colleagues from Turkey, in Turkish university, are just threatened in a very big trial just because they wrote online that there was that you couldn't choose between repression and terrorism. You need more democracy. They just wrote about a few sentences on democracy online, and the state directly came and tried to control that. Anyway, I won't have time to develop all these other points, but what I want to say is that we should, when we talk about democracy, maybe the more insightful way to look at it is not to focus too much on the internet, on the online world, but on the interplay between online and offline. These two are just built together, experienced together. It's not like an activist online and then someone will demonstrate offline. Actually, they just tweet, they walk, they tweet while they're working, and it's just a personal and a collective experience altogether, and so we have to think much better about these interactions. And the fourth kind and fourth concept democracy may be the one of argumentative democracy. And here the idea is that in democracy, at the end, the best argument will prevail, which is actually why many people are here, because we believe that if you have a really good argument that is much better for the common good, if you make it, even if it's just made by the minority of people, at the end it will prevail. So there are many NGOs, many expert networks who try to build counter expertise, try to monitor the European Union, try to see how alternative policies are rational. They do advocacy, citizen popular education. They're certainly less visible, but they really have some impact on some specific measures at national and at the European level. A few sentences to show you what it is about. The idea here is just the last sentence of the first one. We believe that once we create enough public information, people will mobilize themselves. And the idea is that they also believe they have a real impact on some specific measures. So now, definitely, this is very important. Arguments are really central. They are made in public space. They get sometimes people on the street, but is it that easy? Is it true that the best arguments change the world? I'm afraid that the 2008-2009 financial crisis shows us that it's not the case. Back in 2008, the global justice expert had all the arguments to demonstrate that the crisis would happen, and then all the arguments, all the alternative policies to avoid the next crisis. The arguments were just excellent. They were there, solid, scientific, everything. But at the end, it didn't happen. I mean, there were very few changes, and the best argument didn't prevail, because it's not about arguments, it's about meaning, power relations, and there's a real struggle after the financial crisis, definitely. I think that we should not put too much hope in crisis. What's not changeable is actually not argument or crisis, but the capacity of social movements to bring out the questions posed by the historic situation of a crisis and to advance alternative political visions and economic rationality. So at the end, it is the crisis that was framed back in 2008 and 2009. Even in France, right-wing President Sarkozy said that the power of the financial markets came to an end with the fall of Lehman Brothers. He said it 6 years ago. Who will say that today? No one. Then they reframe the meaning of the crisis as the excess of a welfare state, the fact that we live in too generous welfare state. That's the way the causes of the crisis have been framed afterwards. So it's not only about argument, actually. That's maybe the limit of this conception of democracy. Arguments are important, but the good argument is not enough to change the situation. The fifth kind is the most obvious one, mobilizers. These people will believe that if you want to have an impact, you have to put people on the street. You have to show that you are numerous, that you are strong, that you have a lot of determination. These people are expert in building social movement coalition, in mobilizing people. And in the end, what they hope is that the government will change its mind, implement good politics. So they trust that the government is the one who will take the good decision, but they never trust really government. They say that even progressive governments, you should not trust it really. They will only change if there are sufficient people on the street to demonstrate and to push them toward good policies. For example, here in France again, they had the main change of welfare state basically came from Front Populaire, which was a left-wing government in 1936, before the war. And actually, what they say, which is largely true, is that the government didn't take the measure because it was a left-wing government. They took all this set of measures because there was a very big strike in France. And so it's always the idea that the role of social movement is to press the government and to demonstrate, to show it's strong. So basically here we are with five kind of actors, each and everyone implementing mostly, not only, but mostly some actions towards an element of democracy. As I said, I think it's much more fruitful, much more insightful if we think democracy together, all these forms of democracy together, and not only if we think democracy together, but also if we try to see how very empirically they may combine. But it's not always possible, because it's also partly incompatible. And this was basically also my general scheme, let's say about 7-8 months ago, with the general ideas. I mean, of course, I study almost only progressive actors in different parts of Europe. And basically that many people were not interested anymore in institutional politics, party politics, but they were developing a range of alternative forms of participation, especially among young people. As I said, many young people, few young people voted, for example, in the last European elections. It was the case in many countries. But actually, I think that more recent facts may have questioned this perspective. Many people, mostly among young people, may be back to party politics. And here with two possible interpretations. One is the idea that after social movements, they wanted to occupy politics. That's a title of your books. Or maybe that another way to see it, all this phenomena is to take back this idea of multiple democracy, and then actually institutional democracy also belongs to this white puzzle and is a piece of it. So, as I said, institutional democracy is not enough, but is maybe part of the game. And I was quite surprised, especially in the UK, by this contrast. 2011, Occupy London, you cannot recognize any dominant color, you don't see anything, and there were definitely anti-parties. 4 years later, all these young people, enthusiastic, right, voting for the Labour Party elections, which is a real question. What everyone said is, if you want to get young people back into politics, you have to develop new ways of doing politics. So my question is that what new ways of doing politics look like? These trendy young people. I think, of course, I mean, here we discussed it a bit before. I don't want to enter into the internal politics of Labour. That's not my point. My point is that I'm challenged by the fact that not only in the UK, in many countries, many young people are back to party politics. We cannot deny it. Then we may discuss if it is an efficient way, if it's a good thing, a bad thing. I would think that if young people get involved, it's always quite good. But I don't know how efficient it will be, that's another question. But no one can deny that these two people had such a success among young people. And I think we have to take at least three lessons about young people participation when we have a look at Jeremy Corbyn election. First, Jeremy Corbyn is many things, but not a geek. It's not that he didn't have a Twitter account, he had it. But how did he campaign? Not only online, he did 99 meetings in towns in just 100 days. So direct meeting, what a contrast. Just 3 months ago, I was in a meeting in Budapest on young people participation with the European Commissioner on Youth. And he said, very proudly, I will be in touch with over 1 million young people over the next 4 years in my mandate. 1 million people, thanks to new technology. This idea that if you want to mobilize young people, you just put a few tweets, a few Facebook, and some trendy things, and then you get them. Well, I think the Jeremy Corbyn shows us that's actually not the way. That's not what young people expect, and they're not so stupid. The second point is definitely directly addresses some issues of the young people. If he does it in a good way or a bad way, it's another discussion, but definitely he addresses cuts, inequalities, education price in England, because it seems that Scotland is obviously much different on this point, DROs, contracts, and all that. He said, this is a campaign about hope, about democracy, about opportunity for young people. So the fact that it was not so much about making a trendy website, it was about addressing young people in his way. And the third point, which may be the most important one, is that young people saw him as an authentic person. He believes in what he says. This idea of personal ethics, the relation to oneself, this consistency, is really something that they are looking for in politics too. So I think most of us agree that aside of all this debate, if it's a good choice or not, well, that's what many young people thought about it. So are we back to old politics? Is it old politics? Well, not exactly. First, I think it wouldn't have happened without digital media. I said that digital media were not the core of the campaign, but all that happened also online. So it's not only offline, it's like, once again, the interplay between online and offline. And secondly, I think what is more interesting is that it is an attempt, an experiment to combine different forms of democracy, to combine representative democracy with direct democracy using different forms and tools to foster participation. And I think in this perspective, the question to the Prime Minister where people can just send questions, of course it's quite symbolic, but it shows an attempt to combine different forms of democracy. Oops, and then if we take that as a part of a multiple democracy, then we see that there are actually many experiments going on over Europe. And we also have to see of combining more direct democracy and representative democracy. And we also have to face that most of them have been a failure so far. Baath Party in Germany, the aim of this party that got a lot of people elected in Berlin was to that the elected representative would vote as the people online vote on each question they raised. It lasted 2 years and then they had some leadership problems. Five Stars Party in Italy was the same purpose at the beginning with this Pepe Grillo. They also wanted to have a much more participatory politics, much more direct democracy. They ended up basically, I won't enter into the details, but basically with a very strong leader deciding about everything, excluding most of the people of its own party. So not really a bright future. Then we have today the experiments of Podemos. Podemos is a party that came out of, no, a party that is inspired by the Indignados, the Spanish Occupy movement. And but is it really about translating only direct democracy into institutional politics? As soon as you go and see a bit closer, not really. No one could, a few years ago, name a leader of the Occupy movements in Spain, of the Indignados movement, no one. Not that they are, that some of them are a party, everyone knows the leader, Pablo Iglesias. So it's such a transformation of the movements. It's not the same movement, it's actually they transformed very much. They have adopted a much more vertical way of functioning. They are much less horizontal and much organized in a very different way. So they may be inspired by the Occupy movements, but they're also quite different, which may make a very interesting mix. We will see maybe after the next election. And yes, because the last point would be that if we think about multiple democracy, we have to see all these kind of ideas democracy, but also we have to reflect much more about the way they may combine, how they may work partly together with a lot of tension, and especially to decenter our vision or perspective from institutional politics. Institutional politics as a piece, maybe an important one, but just a part of democracy. In this perspective, social movements have many impacts, and not only impact in the institutional arena. They also have impact in daily life. At the same time, there is no direct translation from a social movement to institutional politics. It goes through many different ways. And the very last slide is that I believe that if we have a look at democracy in these different ways, not only in the institutional world, if we look at it also at a local, national, and global scale, with different forms of citizenship, we have some elements, some parts of our reflection of one of the main challenges today. And here I quote Martin Orba that hopefully you have already received here, or he will hopefully come very soon. He says very rightly that global democracy and global citizenship remain for the most part to be invented. And I think that taken together, these multiple forms of democracy offer concrete ways forward for this multidimensional approach to deal with democracy, with first of all with the social limits of representative democracy, but also towards more democratic societies. That's right, thank you.